Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again, and happy new year. I hope the year is treating you well so far. And I have an awesome guest today, a fellow superhuman, and I call everyone that. And we are going to talk about biological aging, getting into depth with that, and a very cool test, assessment, whatever you want to call it, that is really a game changer. So we don't have to wait 40, 50 years to learn about what's really going on in our body. So I'm here with Ryan Smith. He is a biochemist, co-founder of True Diagnostic, which is a company that is focused on the methylation array-based diagnostics for life extension and preventative healthcare. If you're not totally familiar with some of the things I just said, don't worry. It will all make sense very shortly. So without further ado, Ryan, how's it going, man?
Yeah. Hey, Julian, thanks for having me. Excited to talk and introduce some of your listeners to Biological Age.
Yeah, man, I'm really excited to talk about this. This is something that I always mention to clients, where we're talking about, you know, chronological age. You may be 35, but depending on your lifestyle and everything, you can kind of have a shock that you're really 55 on a cellular level. And then some people vice versa, they're like 26. So as we start this, let's dive into some of your origin story a little bit. So growing up, would you have predicted that you are doing what you're doing right now?
Absolutely not. I think, my background just from an undergrad perspective is biochemistry. So I've always known that I'm really interested in, you know, science, and different mechanisms, but for what it's worth, never really was interested in the aging process, even as, myself, I'm aging, my parents are aging. And that has sort of changed. After undergrad, I went to medical school, got really interested in medicine, loved the work, but got to the clinical portion and it just realized it wasn't for me. I think a lot of times it was treating people who were always and already sick. And so decided to go a little bit of a different direction and creating a compounding pharmacy, which specialized in really innovative and unique molecules. And that's really, I was introduced to this world of preventative medicine. And that was exciting to me because you can start to impact these patients from before they get sick. And that's always a lot easier. Any physician would tell you it's easier to prevent damage than it is to fix it. And so this idea of preventive medicine became really, really exciting to me. And so, didn't know I had a passion for that until I sort of stumbled upon this integrative functional medicine community. And then once sort of being in there with a lot of the really cool and innovative products, really cool and innovative interventions, the one thing that I saw to be really important was the question of how do we measure the efficacy of these things? And so that began sort of my second career phase into True Diagnostic and sort of what we're doing now.
So I'm curious, creating the compound pharmacy, I left medical school after 1 year. And so that was enough for me. And so I had a lot of friends who are pharmacists, and that's a very regulated industry that has a lot of red tape, I'm not going to say bad things. I'm not going to bad talk it today. I'm going to be on my good behavior today. So entering something like that, what was some of the initial hurdles that you had to come through? Because I say that because I'm sure there's a few listeners out there who are maybe in the process of starting their business or want to, and they're entering an industry that's is pretty traditional, but they're trying to maybe disrupt it a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And that's essentially what we try to do as well. Obviously, pharmacies and the pharmacy world is a massive space. And we came in with really one idea, which is that we wanted to do these innovative products and make them available, things that we have a pretty good success and proven track record in helping patients. But we're relatively, not well known between physicians or patients. And so sort of educating them on those opportunities and then providing the product was something we were really excited about. And as you mentioned, by far the biggest hurdle in that was, outside of educating and education to some of these physicians was the regulatory piece. And unfortunately, a lot of those regulatory pathways we were using have essentially closed. Compounding pharmacies are definitely, under a very close eye and scrutiny of the government due to some things that have happened in the past, which have been unfortunate. And so compounding pharmacies are undergoing, a huge regulatory sort of change. But with that being said, I think that what we were able to do in that pharmacy was really take that idea and bring it to fruition. We were able to, we were the fourth fastest growing company in healthcare. We just sort of hit a niche because these molecules were things that were really helping patients. Patients had great results. Physicians had great results. And it spread by that success. And so, but those molecules, as I mentioned, were always in various stages of FDA approval. And so as someone who definitely has a respect for well-validated science, I think it was important to get more of that science. And for that, we were always looking at that biomarkers, whether it be, blood-based biomarkers or functional biomarkers. And then this idea of epigenetic methylation clocks came out. And it seemed like a really exciting thing for the same thing you mentioned earlier, which is that these are ways to quantify the age of your body and sometimes even do really science fiction type things like predicting death, right? And so what these can do is sort of really accelerate some of the insights we're getting from these patients and data. And that's what excited me about it.
So let's dive into that a little bit. So the process of even measuring biological age, how do you even like measure that? How does that even start? Because a lot of times people can be skeptical of these things, right? Because you get these results about how do I know how accurate they are?
Yeah, definitely. Good question. And one that has a multitude of answers. This idea of biological age, I think it's first important to tell why it's important. And most of the people will probably think of this intuitively, but the biggest risk factor for almost every chronic disease and death, we're talking metabolic disease, diabetes, stroke, heart attack, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, the number one risk factor for the majority of those diseases, any chronic disease, is age. And so we know that age plays a massive role in whether or not we're healthy. There's a reason we don't see a lot of 30-year-olds have strokes and heart attacks and some of those other things. And so so age has always been, an emphasis in the healthcare community. But there's always been a relatively big problem, which is the way that we quantify age, which is just generally our chronologic ages, is not always the most accurate, right? We know that we probably all know people in their 70s who look like they're in their 50s and vice versa. And so that way to quantify age, we know it's important, but chronological age doesn't always tell us a lot. And so we wanted a better way to do this. And this is not just something that we've been looking into, but people for decades have been investigating. And so what is the standard is sort of the question of how we can see how old the body is or how well the body is aging. And so there are some standards for that. The American Federation of Aging Research has developed some standards. But there are multiple ways that people have done this. Really, I always mention some very, very crude measurements that, where people have been taking their chronological age and adding one, a year for every pack per day they smoked, right? Really, really simple and not very accurate ways. And so that's even been done with things like telomeres. It's been done with even blood-based measurements. And so there are a lot of things you could judge that on. But I think that really in 2013, there was a really big step forward where they are investigating some of new biomarkers, basically things that we're just now able to test at large scale, and we know have major impacts on disease. And one of those was this idea of epigenetic methylation. And what it was able to do is to really objectively standardize biological age, but its predictions were also very, very accurate. So it was able to, better than most measurements of biological age, relate this to disease-related processes. So that if we know someone is aging quicker by this measurement, or then we know that they're probably more at risk. If we know that people are aging slower by this measurement, we know that they're protected. And so this measurement looks to be probably the most accurate way to quantify biological age at the moment. moment. And that will always change. I think that, you know, ideally as this new world of medicine involves things like artificial intelligence and computer learning, the more information we can feed these things, the better. However, as a standalone biomarker, the epigenetic methylation is very, very effective in telling us how our aging process is going.
So can you look at the, when you look at the genome here, right? Is there specific markers that are going to, do certain markers accelerate faster than others, depending on like the lifestyle that you're doing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in order to really explain that, it might be better to go into just a general explanation of what we're measuring, which is this methylation. And so most people are familiar with DNA tests, right? Like 23andMe or Ancestry.com. Everyone's probably seen those. And what they are measuring are essentially your DNA sequence. So, you know, what is happening in all over your body? If you got that DNA from a skin cell or a saliva sample, it's going to be the same DNA sequence. However, epigenetics is a little different, right? You know, whenever we're sort of growing and proliferating from, you know, these sperm and oocyte, what we're essentially doing is changing the way that our multiple cells behave, right? The expression of the genes in our heart are very different than the expression of the genes from our skin. And the reason is they behave differently, and we want them to behave differently. And so the way that we regulate that is by turning certain genes on or off in different types of tissues. And so our hearts are expressing a lot different genes than our skin, and for good reason. And so the way that they control that are by these little on or off switches. Usually that off switch is called DNA methylation, where they sort of attach a little bit of a just sort of a carbon group, which prevents genes from being transcribed into RNA, which would then initiate their, you know, the sort of transcription process or their activation. Alternatively, you can also use a molecule, an acetyl molecule, to activate some of those genes. And so that sort of off and on switches are things that our bodies start from the moment the sperm meets the egg, and we continue it throughout our entire life. And unfortunately, you know, really prior to, you know, the 2010s, we weren't able to really measure this at large scale or super effectively. But the data that is generated, the amount of places we can look at in every cell is around 29 million, and each cell is widely different. So you can imagine that's a lot of data. And so what I oftentimes talk about whenever I talk about our company is we're really trying to create the Rosetta Stone, so to speak, of how to interpret that data. That data is now finally available at a really large scale, and we're just trying to learn how to read it and interpret it. And some of the work that people have done way before our company was started have been able to turn these markers into information on aging. And the way that they do that is by taking a lot of data, you know, looking at 400, 500,000 spots in the genome, and then seeing what effectively changes in all these patients with age, right? If you look at 1,000, 2,000 patients, you see some of these markers are tend to become very hypermethylated or hypomethylated as we age, which gives us a way to sort of create these predictive algorithms, which say by reading your data on how well or how much or how little this is methylated, we can give an idea of how old you are. And so that was really exciting because it was very, very objective. And it immediately was already used in very exciting ways. It was used in, you know, crime scene investigations. It's used in forensics to tell how old someone is if they leave their DNA at a crime scene, and even with refugees to see if someone's an adult or a minor. And so it was almost immediately after it was created, it was so specific that it started to be used in really specific use cases all around the world. And the idea then is, how can we use this information to go after health? And right now, this is an absolute explosion in the biotech and health space, where people are looking at how to read these methylation marks for every type of disease, every type of prediction, you know, and maybe even things that are not necessarily diseases, things like, you know, physical functioning or mental processing speeds or IQ or a lot of those other things that are affecting our daily lives. And so if there's one thing to really take away from this talk, it's that epigenetic methylation as a biomarker will be around for a long, long time. It's going to affect every single disease. Already there are tests on the market which can detect up to 50 types of cancers and tell you exactly where they are in your body. And so this is a biomarker that is just now beginning. It's sort of where DNA was 30 years ago. But our company particularly has specialized in age-related diagnostics, because as I mentioned, age is the number one risk factor for all chronic disease and death. And if we can change that, we can change people's risk. And I always say the statistic, but I think it's worth mentioning, is that if everyone in the world were to be 7 years younger biologically than they are chronologically, we'd be able to cut disease in half. And that's pretty incredible, right? And definitely within everyone's grasp, if they can go ahead and measure themselves and then do the things required to reverse that aging process.
Wow, that's a lot of money saved. That's a lot of money. Yeah, that's a lot. Because aging, you know, a lot of times people forget that aging not only is for a risk factor for all these chronic diseases, but it's also an economic disaster.
Absolutely.
As a byproduct of all the chronic diseases and illnesses that it comes with.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, especially with an aging population, which we certainly have, it becomes even more of an impact. And so the idea, you know, even if everyone in the world were just to change their aging rate by 20%, we could save just the U.S. Alone $3 trillion in healthcare spending per year. I mean, that's a massive amount. And so this makes a big difference, right? And so that's really what we're trying to get people to think about now is to approach age a little bit differently, not as something that is, inevitable, but something that is a biological process, one that is directly linked to our ability to function, to look the way we want, to feel the way we want, and then also for our ability to stay out of the hospital or stop being sick. And so we believe aging is a disease. I think there's a lot of movement going to that direction. And we're really being able to hopefully quantify it so we know exactly what treats it. So we can look at the interventions that we might recommend, or we can look at some of the things that have been well validated to prevent those outcomes. And as you mentioned, it'll save a ton of money for everyone individually, as well as our society as a whole. But beyond that, it just makes people's lives better. And, you know, I think that we can talk about this a little bit later as well, but it's not just about living longer. It's also just about living better. So you're not, having to choose between, you know, making these life decisions or being happy. It is both.
Absolutely. And so when we do this test and we get our results back, is there a variance of, say, I'm 35 and the test comes back and it says I'm 29. Yeah. Is there like a range, give or take, or is that number the exact number?
So that number is the exact number as measured by these algorithms. But these algorithms are constantly being changed and updated with new information or being trained to better ways. And so the algorithms themselves can be a little bit complicated sometimes. And that's why I always like to separate the things that we do into two different steps. One is the data generation, where we're actually testing your DNA. And the other one is how we interpret that. And so some algorithms are better than others. But generally, the result that you would get from our test is relatively accurate. It will tell you sort of where you're at and then give you an idea of how your current status is affecting your risk of disease. So we'll tell you, you know, if you're accelerated aging, how that might affect your risk of you know, things like cancer or things like cardiovascular disease or some of those other things. And again, it's linked objectively to all of those other things. So we can actually give you real metrics on how your relative risk is increased or decreased. And the one thing that I think we probably haven't emphasized as much is that unlike your DNA, you can't change your DNA sequence, right? Unless you're doing some really, really high tech related things. But
right.
That being said, for epigenetics, this is something that your body regulates and you can actually change this, at least in certain locations. And so there are things you can do to actually reverse your aging process and things that have been published to show exactly that. And so so in addition to knowing and putting an emphasis on age, it's also important to put an emphasis on the things that hopefully improve that process.
Yes. And so we'll come back to that because that's a very important point to make. But before that, I want to talk about some of the things that maybe accelerate aging that you've noticed. Now, this show is filled with entrepreneurs as well. And we tend to be type A, highly stressed individuals, sometimes probably don't sleep as much as we should. I'm guilty of that one as well. And so stress is not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually a good thing in the right dosages. But is stress the number one thing? If I had to guess, if I'm at the casino and I'm going to place a bet on something, is stress the number one thing for accelerated aging?
You know, I would say it's highly up there. I think that, stress is perceived in a lot of different ways. As you mentioned, some things like physical stress, right, like working out are great for our bodies. But it's this consistent process of stress, which does look to have a major impact in how we age. You know, one of the things I always like to point out about these algorithms, in particular, the first ever algorithm created, the Horvath 2013 clock, 85 of the 353 loci that they used to calculate calculate age are located near these glucocorticoid receptors, which are obviously expressed or changed by stress. And so we know that from even a functional perspective of these gene regulations, that they're highly tied to stress. But we also see that in larger meta-analyses that stress increases aging. And you know, there are a lot of other things, I would say, in that sort of epidemiological knowledge base that we know affect aging. Things, as you mentioned, like worse sleep quality. Smoking obviously has a really detrimental effect, as we would anticipate. High levels of drinking. Physical activity is great, but too much physical activity can be bad. And so we know a lot about these things from an epidemiological perspective. We know things that are positively or negatively associated with aging. And one of the, and I would say those are not necessarily too groundbreaking, because most of the things that we know are things that you would probably intuitively think, right? Stress is bad. Sleep is, or at least should say some sleep, at least moderate and consistent amounts are great. Not smoking, not drinking too much, not exercising too much, and putting your body under too much of that physical stress. And so a lot of those things are intuitive. We also know that the typical markers you'd like to avoid from general health, right? Like high levels of inflammation for what it's worth, even high triglycerides low HDL, all of those things are things you would want to avoid, because all of them also show effects on this epigenetic aging process. And so so there are a lot of things that we know just generally, but there are a lot of other more interesting things that we're finding out. And I would say stress fits into that category, where we're seeing people who practice mindfulness or practice meditation or stress reduction strategies can make a difference in their epigenetic aging process.
What's been, now you looked at tons of data by this point now, what's been some of the most interesting findings that has surprised you from all this data?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we find is that there's definitely a racial component. There's things, for instance, called like the Latin paradox, where they might have better aging rates despite having more incidence of some of those other chronic diseases, right? Like metabolic disease. Yeah. And so that's been interesting. I think that some of those population level components are sometimes surprising. In addition to that, I think that some of the effects that we've seen from medications that we were really, really hopeful for, things like metformin haven't seemed to have as big of an impact as we might have thought. And so, and I say all that with caveats, because, the data is always growing and generating. But even I would say the sex-based differences, what we see from, women tend to age a little bit better than men. And we see that in some cases, some covariate things like high blood pressure, for instance, in women can actually increase their epigenetic age a little bit more than high blood pressure in men. And so we're starting to find, a lot of sex-based differences, a lot of population-based differences. And then we're especially looking at how a lot of treatments affect these particular categories. And I think that's been surprising as well, because some of the things I would have placed, pretty big bets on as well have been things that don't pan out to be, as beneficial. And again, all of these things are growing. I would also mention that one of the most interesting things, I think, from a societal level standpoint, is that we have a really, really cool algorithm that, and a lot of times I should mention that the thing we output is an age, right? Where it tells you how old you are versus your chronological age. But we output other things as well. We output things like telomere length, or we output things like how many immune cells of each type you have. And one of the other things we also read out is another aging metric, which tells you your instantaneous rate of aging. And that one has been really, really exciting as well, because what we've started to see, and we've tracked these individuals from since when they were 3 years old now all the way to their age 45. And some of the things we found are that things like socioeconomic status and the amount of child stress and polyvictimization can greatly increase these aging rates. And when these increase in children, they can actually even predict outcomes at age 45. And so I think a lot of people oftentimes think of age as something you need to start thinking about in, your 40s and 50s, and that's not necessarily the case. Even in early adult life, even actually before conception, we're seeing epigenetic marks which affect each other's aging rate. And so I think that as aging becomes more solidified and more recognized as a disease, we'll also start to sort of view how we view social dynamics and things like population level statistics in terms of fixing this aging process and treating a lot of those individuals who might just be at higher risk for aging.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I know a few people who specialize now in preconception programs.
Absolutely.
Like, because you always hear, yes, you want to be healthy before conceiving, but I didn't know the amount of detail and the just how pivotal that is until recently. So that's pretty cool. And then also the racial thing. And I think intuitively, we've always heard different racial groups have certain issues that pop up more. At least I know I have. Like, there's certain things that run in my family. And so I guess that's probably a genetic component as well. And then the epigenetics kicks in as well.
Yeah. You know, it's sometimes hard to say because, you know, a lot of times, racial identities are also very tied to, different social processes, right? The amount of support structure in a community or even the foods you're eating or behaviors that you're having. And so it's sometimes hard to draw out what's genetic or what's social. But with that being said, we are starting to learn a little bit more about that to really answer that question of nature versus nurture, right? To say, you know, this is the amount that is contributed from, you know, some of the baseline DNA or even the genetics passed down from, epigenetics, I should say, passed down from us from future generations. A very cool paper actually came out this week, which showed that, in the Rwanda genocide, they're actually even now generations later still have epigenetic marks, which signal the stress of that event. And we've seen the same with famine, for instance, in different periods of the world where descendants of people who have undergone famine have different epigenetic marks and regulation. And so preconception is absolutely, I would say a monumental area for family planning for some of these markers in health. And we're definitely investigating that as well. Without going too off topic, we're investigating something called the imprintome, and this is basically, most people are aware that from you get two pairs of DNA, one from your parents, one from each parent. However, oftentimes, some of the DNA you receive from one parent, at least epigenetically, is deactivated, which puts all of the emphasis on your health onto the parent that actually gave you the activated version of those genes. And as a result, there are problems with that. They can be really penetrable, as we would call them, or they mean that you're basically going to see a phenotype happen in the child. And so even that imprintome related work is interesting. I mean, there are papers published even just 2 months ago showing that, for instance, marijuana can increase some of the markers which have been shown to be correlated with autism, for instance, and definitely in sperm. And so this is definitely a growing area, but I think it just goes to show you once again that epigenetics generally is a marker which will be used a lot in the future in a lot of different ways. But as it affects the aging process, it goes to show you that although you can change these methylation marks, you still have to know where you're starting from because you're receiving these things from your parents and grandparents. And so you want to get an idea of where you're starting. And then no matter where you're starting, we don't want you to be scared of this marker. If you're aging 5-6 years faster, that's okay. You just now know that that's your goal to get that lower. And so we never want anyone to be scared by these metrics. We want them to use it as a baseline. And for everyone, no matter if you're 15 years younger, we still want you to compete with yourself to get that as low as possible, because the lower you get it, the less at risk you are for every chronic disease.
Yeah, I'd rather know something now than have it become a big, it's like having a little crack in a dam right now and that you can still do something about than waiting years later and it's just going to just burst apart and too much damage has been done then. So I really like that point there, because a lot of times I think even I've had people that have been nervous just to go get lab work because they don't want to see it in case it's quote unquote bad. Yeah. But I mean, you can fix it. You can work on it, but you got to know what you're shooting at.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing I always say as well as it relates to sort of that knowledge is that, as I mentioned before, it's easier to fix things before they go bad rather than to fix it once they're bad. But beyond that, everyone has a context for age, right? And so I think oftentimes people are a little bit more scared of this metric than they might be for things like their C-reactive protein or their triglycerides, where they don't necessarily know the reference range. And so here, everyone knows how old they should be. And that might cause a little bit of fear, but this should not be a metric which you fear. It should be one that you, again, want to try and drive as low as possible. You want to keep seeing benefit and in a way that you can actually track that too, right? And so in a way that not just preventing your risk for one disease, but preventing risk for all of them.
Yeah, I would be nervous. If anything, I would think people should be nervous maybe of the Horvath's clock, right? That's the one that tells you about like predicting about your death, right?
Yeah. So that particular clock is called Grim Age.
Grim Age, yeah.
Yeah. And it has, it absolutely can predict when you might want to die, which, you know, from an individual perspective may or may not be a good thing. It's one of those things that we have not gone after commercializing because, you know, some of the ethical implications I would say there, but beyond that, you know, it is still one of the algorithms is most highly correlated to health outcomes. And so, you know, that's not the only output of that algorithm. It also, you know, references an age. And so, but it goes to show you again, some of the power and from a researcher perspective, what that allows us to do is look at how some of those, you know, new molecules, even some of those new fitness or diet or lifestyle interventions are affecting, you know, things 50 or 60 years from now. And so it allows us to really accelerate what we might be able to know about the outcomes of these studies by really getting a good idea on trajectory. And so it's a great clinical research tool. And hopefully the information that we can gather from that will lead everyone to have more tools for once they take their tests to reverse that process.
So we get the test back, and you mentioned instantaneous rate of aging, and then we have our actual age that we are. And so instantaneous rate of aging, that's how much we're aging. And so you could be aging, right?
Yeah. So really the outcome is a number between really right around 0.6 to around 1.4. And that is how many biological years per year are you aging? So it's sort of like a speedometer of how fast you're aging at this moment. And sometimes, you know, for instance, if people have had, you know, some unhealthy histories, right, where they might not have been taking care of themselves. We can see people have really high biological ages, but if they've changed some of those processes, we might still see high biological ages, but really good rates of aging as they're starting to turn around this process. I think that dichotomy of the overall picture versus your current trajectory is really helpful in determining what's working and what's not, right? You know, some people might implement a certain type of nutritional protocol, maybe keto or Mediterranean diet or the carnivore diet and see how that works for them to say, hey, is my aging rate increasing or decreasing? And it gives us a little bit more instantaneous feedback on what works for us.
How often would you recommend people kind of retest and reassess?
Yeah. So this is it's a good question. One that unfortunately consistently changes, because of the sensitivity and precision of these algorithms. And so generally some algorithms now I would say are conducive to more frequent testing, but we almost would always recommend no more than twice per year. If you're doing it once more than every 6 months, it might not be specific or sensitive enough to really pick up that aging signal. And it might just be picking up noise that happens, you know, throughout the process of the actual lab process. And so 6 months is generally the most frequent we would recommend it. But in the future, I think that some of those algorithms will be improved to do it every 8 weeks or 12 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. And just another question is, so I forgot, I think I read a paper or I talked to someone and they're really into this field and they contracted COVID and then they tested the telomeres and their telomeres decreased. So if your telomeres were to increase naturally, then that would have an effect on your aging. So what have you noticed in that area with COVID and aging?
So a lot. So actually, we just recently published an article with Cornell and Yale where we looked at some of those longitudinal changes in epigenetics methylation from baseline to when someone developed COVID and then shortly thereafter. And one of the things we found is that generally, like you mentioned, telomere length has been proven now several times in several different studies shortens after an exposure to COVID-19. And so we actually found the same thing. We saw that there was significant telomere length shortening in a variety of individuals. And for anyone who's not familiar with telomeres, they are another marker which has been used to sort of functionally gauge this aging process. Because as we get older, our telomeres are sort of these end caps of our DNA get shorter and shorter and shorter. And so they definitely play a role in aging. They're actually one of those nine hallmarks of aging. However, in a recent study, they looked at sort of the in twins who have exactly the same genetic information, they tried to then look at the phenotypic differences, so the aging differences between those same twins. And what they generally found is that right around 2% of that variance has been attributed to things like telomere length shortening. So that's a relatively small amount, while right around 25% of that variance has been essentially attributed to these epigenetic dysregulation. And so telomeres are an important process of aging, but probably separate and a little bit maybe less influential than some of these epigenetic epigenetic markers. But with that being said, we also looked at these epigenetic age clocks in COVID in that same study. And what we found there was also really, really interesting. And that is, we found, you know, most people would expect to see an aging increase with COVID, as we're seeing, you know, telomeres shorten. And we did find that, but really we only found that for people who were over 50 years of age. Actually, for people under 50 years of age, we actually saw an aging decrease. And that is interesting. And maybe some of the thought processes behind that, if we had to speculate, would be that younger people can mount a better immune response, a better hormetic response, which actually, you know, shows some improvement and improves their ages, while those people who are over 50 are unable to mount that same response from an immune perspective, leading them to, you know, higher levels of inflammation, higher insults, which they're unable to recover from, which increases that aging process. And so that was, I would say, a really interesting study, because we didn't expect to see that line in the sand, right, where you would have differential responses according to your chronological age. So it was really, really interesting. And I think overall, most people would tell you that COVID is not a good thing for aging. And I think that would probably be something we back up. And then in addition to that, we also looked at those mRNA-based vaccines to look at how those vaccines are changing before and after as well, and got a really interesting result there, with most people taking the vaccine showing an anti-aging effect as well.
Interesting. Well, I guess in the future, aren't mRNA technology is going to be a huge thing, you know, especially if we're going to cross the natural typical barrier when it comes to aging, right? Like, if you're going to live 120 plus years, you're going to really have to rely on that kind of technology.
Yeah, you know, we're still uncertain if it's the mRNA-based vector technology, or if it's just a vaccine in general. Okay. And so that's one of the questions we want to answer, is how does, you know, things like the traditional flu or influenza vaccine actually affect aging? But I would absolutely agree with you. Some of those, you know, new strategies, I would say, on reprogramming cells or to reduce burden of senolytic cells, a lot of these delivery and identification methods are going to be vastly important. And so I think that as we continue to develop these data sets, they'll just tell us more and more and more about what's working and what's not.
Yeah. So this is a more specific question. So, you know, so say someone gets the report back, and because things like peptides, right? Yep. Peptides. So when you get your report back and you see your aging and everything, and how is that broken down enough to where you're going to have an idea of specific interventions that will maybe be ideal to help you improve that?
Definitely. And so we break this biological aging process down into an intrinsic age and an extrinsic age. And those can be relatively complicated to explain. But generally, one is that baseline fundamental process of aging. The other one is more of an immune system aging perspective. And both are important because they each have different risk, but most importantly, they each have different treatments which have been published to reverse those processes. And so the first thing we would generally try and do is say, you know, out of things like intrinsic aging, extrinsic aging, the rate of aging, and telomere length, what looks to be the most alarming? What is providing you the highest risk as an individual? And then we'd probably focus on going over the things which have been published in the clinical literature that have shown to reverse or change those baseline risk factors. And so we do give a little bit of recommendation, but generally we also require that people go through a lot of this analysis with, you know, sort of health coaches or providers or people who have a little bit more knowledge of this on a day-to-day basis and a little bit knowledge of the trends, because, you know, these things have been validated really extensively at population level scales, but are just now being applied to an individual. And I think that having someone who had some of that experience to go through with you can really make even better recommendations on how to reverse that process. We definitely also, I think people might be going through this and saying, you know, is age the thing that causes the disease, or do those diseases cause aging? And I think the answer is both. We know, as I mentioned, that some of those disease processes, which are unhealthy, might contribute to faster aging. And we also know that faster aging without any disease processes actually encourage the development of those diseases. And so aging is important either way. And for those people who have, I would say, some type of comorbidity, some type of diagnosed disease, it's definitely important you treat that first. But then after that, the idea would be, how can you optimize all the other areas of your life?
Yeah. So I probably know the answer to this next question, but anytime that, at least that I'm sure you're familiar with it, anytime you're associated with anything longevity, anti-aging related, people are going to ask you, what are some of the key things I can do to reverse the aging process?
Yeah. You know, it's and I would say that a lot of work needs to be done on this in the field, just generally. There are a million studies out there about how things reverse the aging process. And as it relates to the epigenetics, there actually are not that many. The first ever interventional trial showing a baseline measurement and then a treatment and then an outcome only happened in the fall of 2019. And so that was right before the pandemic, where a lot of research stopped. And so right now there are about 8 or 9 different interventional trials which do that same idea. And some of the things that have shown positive effects are combinations of things like metformin, growth hormone, and DHEA. That was sort of the first ever trial that was published, called the TRIM trial out of UCLA. In addition to that, we've seen things like vitamin D supplementation having really robust anti-aging effects in overweight individuals. We've seen, for instance, in some of our own trials, that things like senolytics, like dasatinib and quercetin, or things that kill senolytic cells, or those sort of zombie cells, as people call them, that secrete inflammation, things that get rid of those unnecessary cells, tend to have an anti-aging effect. We've seen that, some diet and nutrition things, Mediterranean diets are always really, really great whenever we look at them for these biological aging processes. And so and then a lot of those other epidemiological things we mentioned, right? Stress reduction, doing some activity, but not too much, maybe even drinking some beer or wine, but not too much, right? There seems to be, I would say, some of those, curves where we see some things being good, but too much of the same thing being bad. And so I think moderation in a lot of areas of life, but definitely stress reduction, definitely some supplementation with a couple of nutritional factors. And then we're starting to learn a little bit more about medications as well, and senolytics, as well as plasma exchange and stem cells, all look to be relatively promising areas that can have, relatively big changes in these age measurements.
Yeah, I think I saw a recent report. I think it was Rejuven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I appreciate, you bringing that up. So Rejuven is a ingredient which includes calcium alpha-ketoglutarate. And this has been a molecule that has been studied a lot for aging. It's one of those ingredients in the Krebs cycle, hopefully everyone remembers from your biology, but with that being said, I think that so alpha-ketoglutarate they showed in that study what they called to be a 6 or 7 year age reduction. The only problem with that is that the measurement that they use, that algorithm they use to show that change, has not been published or validated, and so that presents a relatively big problem, because we can't always compare apples to apples, right? If we, created, our own clock that basically said, if we change this one spot, we would see 100%, 100 year age reduction. We could probably do that. But the answer would be, does it actually correlate to changes in the health outcomes? And without published studies, it's really hard to say that. And so for anyone who's interested in this topic of epigenetic methylation, there are a couple things that I would say, I would highly encourage you to do before you get this testing. One is to validate the collection method. Right now, the algorithms that have been published are almost always published as blood-based algorithms, meaning that if you're taking a sample from your urine or your skin or your saliva, it's probably not based on an algorithm which has been validated in the literature. The second thing I always recommend is that the algorithm that the companies are using, make sure you ask if it's been published. Because you will want to see how your age relates to your increased risk or decreased risk of disease. And the way that is done is by using these really large scale cohorts, by things like the Framingham Heart Study, et cetera, and looking at how this change in algorithm, affects some of those health-related outcomes. And so those are two very, very important things. And then the last thing I would mention for anyone doing this testing is that the scale of the testing matters. We're measuring for every test right around 900,000 locations in the blood. So we're looking at 900,000 genes in their expression. I would say the next nearest commercial company will use right around 100, 115,000, some doing as little as 1,500. The reason that that's important is, as I mentioned, these things are on a daily basis. We're seeing improvements in algorithms. We're seeing new features of these interpretations. And so you want an algorithm that can also then grow with you as well, right? So that the information you get isn't immediately outdated, over the next, 2 weeks, so to speak. And so something that can be continually updated is also important. And for that reason, we use the same testing mechanism that almost any clinical research trial would use as well. And so for anyone that's evaluating this, those are three really important things. Make sure it's blood, make sure the algorithm has been published, and make sure you're getting a relatively robust measurement, because that is going to be able to be updated.
Absolutely. That's very important, because the thing, a knock against this field at times is that it's quack, or it's not, there's no science to prove it or anything like that, because every day it seems like there's new tests popping up and people are curious in it, but how do you know what's legit and what's not? So I think really laying those 3 points out there was very critical and very important right there.
Yeah, definitely. And to mention that even further, as I think we talked about a little bit earlier, there are multiple ways that people also calculate biological age. But I would think that, you know, there are multiple now review studies since 2017, which generally go on statement to say that of all of the measurements thus far, it looks like epigenetic methylation based age is by far the most promising. And so I think that if you're considering measuring your age, I think that methylation presents the best route. And if you're doing methylation specific analysis, those are the 3 questions to ask.
Yeah. And so if listeners are going to order a kit there, I saw there's 2 options, and there's one like the complete collection. What's the difference?
So the difference is the amount of algorithms we're able to actually run on that data. This research, as I've said now multiple times, it has happening everywhere all at the same time, right? There are a lot of people interested in epigenetic methylation, and a lot of people interested in epigenetic methylation-based aging. And so sometimes what happens is that we will have to license a particular algorithm from a university. Our rate of aging algorithm is a really good example. That work has been done since 1975, way before we were even, thinking about aging, or in my case, even alive. And so these data sets have been generated for a long, long time. And so in order to get the access to some of those data, we have to essentially license that from Duke. And so Duke and Columbia are the 2 universities now who sort of represent the continual work on that algorithm. And we're the commercial sort of side of that, where we can then, offer that to consumers. And every time we do that, there's some monetary fees involved. So if we add new algorithms, sometimes we might have to charge a little bit more, but generally we can run all those algorithms on your data. So the complete collection just basically says we're running everything we can on your data and providing you all those results.
Yeah, and this is more precision, pretty much. Like the more data, the more different algorithms, the more tests, the more precise everything's going to be. Is that pretty much the general thing?
Absolutely. It gives you a much, much better picture of your health, right? And that's really what we want is to compare all of these things and see if we can find any patterns, right? And in the future, we absolutely will. We'll be finding patterns. Right now we can, in addition to predicting death, we can predict, probably how well you've been eating over the past few weeks. We can predict how much you've smoked across an entire lifetime, how much you're smoking now, how much you're drinking currently, if they're mild, moderate, or heavy. We can tell you if you've been exposed to heavy metals or different types of environmental plastics or other toxic agents. So the amount of information we're actually being able to generate from this data is growing at a ridiculous scale. Whenever we first came out with our reports in July of 2020, we only had 1 report. And that was to tell you your biological age. Now we have over 15 different reports for things such as, how likely are you to respond to weight loss, how likely are you to respond to caloric restriction for weight loss? Are you, if you reduce your calorie intake, are you really likely to lose weight, or are you not going to lose very much weight, right? There are a lot of papers on a daily basis that are coming out in a variety of different disease states. We can tell you how likely you are to lose your hair, or how likely you are to lose muscle mass as you get older. A lot of these things are being built out. And as we continue to add them, we'll hopefully continue to provide that reporting back to you all.
Yeah, I often say it feels nearly impossible to keep up with everything going on in this field. So at this point, I try to meet as many people as possible in this field, and then I just rely on them, because it's so hard, because there's, like you said, there's new things coming out literally every single day.
Yeah. It is. And it's definitely overwhelming, especially in the aging space, which is, I think, can be overwhelming at times, but ultimately it's a great thing, because it's changing the way that we think about aging, no longer as something that's inevitable, but something we can actually control and change. And I think that, massive levels of investment from the private sector are going in. Even the NIH, or the National Institute of Aging, right, are funding projects which will greatly change the way that we live our lives and how long we live. I think that, you know, most people are probably familiar with that. For over the past couple of years, for the first time in history, our average life expectancy has been going back down, and that is not the type of trajectory we want to encourage, right? And so these are some of the baseline measurements and metrics which are building that larger approach. And as this data, you know, continues to grow, we'll know a lot more, and we'll know a lot more definitively.
And so as we get ready to wrap this up, and what's maybe one or two things that's on the horizon this year that you're really looking forward to?
Yeah, well, there's a lot. I would say, I talked at least a little bit about senescence earlier, and senescence is one of those hallmarks of aging where there's some dysfunction which leads to inflammation in your body, which leads to that process of inflammaging. And currently there are not really great ways to quantify that process. Generally it can be nonspecific and sometimes very expensive to do. We hope to create a lower price point metric to tell you if you might have higher or lower levels of senescent cells than other individuals, which then might see if you're a good candidate for some pharmacological intervention or even some supplemental nutrition like physatin, for instance, which has been shown to reverse some of those cells. So I'm really, really excited about that. We are also coming out with a very, very exciting death predictor clock and age predictor clock, hopefully in the summer of this year, which we're doing in combination with Harvard, which will be a massive and really, really exciting data set. So those are the two things that this year I'm really excited to get done.
Awesome. That sounds amazing. I can't wait to check those things out. But other than that, man, this has been an awesome conversation. And I'm sure listeners have gathered a lot from this. And where can listeners keep up with you, and or where would you like for them to go and to order the test and everything?
Well, so you can always go to trudiagnostic.com, and that's trudiagnostic.com. And there you can find some things on our blog where we talk about some of these the newest developments in the aging field, and particularly in the methylation specific field. And you can sign up for our newsletter, which will also provide you more information. Or if you even want to purchase a test, you can go on there and do that as well. And again, as this continues to grow, we'll hopefully be back on to talk about more updates. But
absolutely,
I hope that people will invest in this idea of aging as a disease and do their best to try and prevent their own aging process.
Absolutely. Cause I'm definitely interested to hear about the senescence, cause that's a growing field that's just has very little information on it right now. So that's a big thing.
Yeah, definitely excited to do that on a follow-up call as well. As we know, we're starting to learn some really exciting things in that category.
So without further ado, listeners, stay awesome, be limitless. And as always, go be superhuman. Peace.